Good morning. It is 9:41, Wednesday, September 9th. This is the TDN Writers Room presented by Keeneland. My name is Joe Bianca. I'm the associate editor of the Thoroughbred Daily News. And tomorrow is football. So it's the annual test of who can have a worse record, the Jets or the Giants.
I am Bill Finley, a correspondent for the Thoroughbred Daily News, and I'll take the Jets. Don't you? You can never go wrong betting against the Jets, right, Joe?
It's true. I should have been hedging this whole time. I should have been hedging my fandom with bets.
Exactly. Jonathan Green, general manager from DJ Stable. And man, this has been a wild and woolly week, starting with the Derby and the Oaks and ending with the big news that's coming down the pike today. How's that for a teaser?
That's a tease.
I'm Alan Carrasso, managing editor of TDN. I apologize for any background noise as I have Carrasso Elementary and Senior High School up above me. And but this is Christmas for me today. It's the opening meet at Happy Valley tonight.
When's recess, Val?
When's what?
When's recess?
8:45, oddly enough.
Well, Al, before we get too far into the show, congratulations on 22 years at the TDN.
Thanks. You can see it, what it's done to me here.
Are you saying that you were handsome before you got hired 22 years ago?
I'm older and grayer. That's what I said. But thank you, John. It's quite been a great ride.
The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Keeneland, the industry-leading Keeneland September yearling sale, which consistently delivers the winners on racing's biggest stages, begins this Sunday, September 13th. Learn more about the sale, including remote bidding options and on-site protocols, at september.keeneland.com. Huge weekend for Keeneland grads. They swept the Derby and the Oaks. Can't do much better than that with Authentic and She Dares the Devil. But some other big wins as well. Global Campaign in the Woodward, getting his first grade one win. Monomoy Girl, of course. We know she's a Keeneland September grad. Princess Noor in the Del Mar Debutante. Bequist in the Spinaway. We'll get to these performances later. Jackie's Warrior in the Hopeful. So almost clean sweep of the grade ones there. And then Sitting on Go as well. Big upset in the Iroquois. Girl Daddy in the Pocahontas. And Analyze It, who is back in the Red Bank Stakes. Stakes that's near and dear to our hearts at the TDN. So a huge weekend for Keeneland grads. Keeneland September this Sunday. Toss it to our resident owner, John Green, about what he's looking forward to.
Well, actually, Joe, I have to admit that while you're doing the preview of the show and the commercial breaks and everything like that, I'm actually cheating by reading the Keeneland book. So I'm going through it every waking moment that we have, because the sale starts Sunday. So, you know, we have teams that are down there. They're going to start looking at horses over the weekend and get us some short lists for us to review. I can watch the videos online, which is outstanding, and communicate very easily, you know, with my team down there. And now I can bid not only on the phone, but also online. So they're making it very, very easy for the fat cats up here in Jersey like us to be able to bid on horses. But I'm going to go back to reading my catalog while you finish up this commercial.
All right. Best of luck, John. Best of luck. Thanks for paying attention, as always. And best of luck to everybody at Keeneland throughout the Keeneland September sale. And that'll lead right into the fall meet and then the Breeders' Cup. So I think there was a big race over the weekend. I saw some people tweeting about something or other. The Kentucky Derby. Am I saying that right? So we finally had the Derby in the Oaks. We waited a long, long time. Seemed like years, honestly. It was probably about 9 months that we were talking about it. Finally happened. And Tis the Law had dead aim on Authentic at the top of the stretch. Looked like he was going to run right on by. Just couldn't do it. Authentic dug in. They thought they both ran big. I thought the idea that there was some kind of excuse needed for Tis the Law. I don't know. I thought he ran his race. Barkley Tag supposedly said he didn't like the track, according to Manny Franco. I didn't really see that. I thought he kind of just ran his race. I ran every other race except the Traverse. And that was my concern going into the race, is that I don't like big favorites who only have that one effort that's a lot better than everybody else. And then a bunch of other races that are good, but don't tower over the field. So I thought he was a little bit vulnerable in there. Though I still thought he would run by at the top of the stretch. You know, the pace was faster than I thought it would be, but for the most part, I think it held together. There were a couple of good performances from back in the pack. I want to give a shout out to John with Mr. Big News running a good third. Was not enough to get him out of the basement in our three-year-old contest, which we'll get to, but still a good showing from him at 46-1. Honor AP ran a huge race, I thought, to be fourth in there. Just kind of went sideways at the start, was way, way back, got wide on both turns, and still put in a pretty good run to be fourth. But Max Player ran an okay race to be fifth, was finishing up okay in there after being way back early on. But the race was really about the top two horses in the showdown at the top of the stretch. And Authentic was really the forgotten horse. And we kind of dismissed him last week. Bill went way overboard saying he wouldn't even put him in the exactas. But I didn't think he was a win candidate either, even though I expected the pace to hold together. And, you know, there was really no excuse for Tizzle. And it was, you got to give full marks to Authentic for really digging in and turning him aside. This wasn't like he just got loose on the lead and was never confronted. He had a real chance to lose that race, determined not to. Obviously, a huge story is the Baffert component. What an interesting, circuitous route he took to this Derby. Seems to have a stranglehold on the race early in the season with Charlatan and Nadal and Authentic, who was probably the third string at that point. Charlatan and Nadal obviously drop off due to injury. He had Uncle Chuck, who seemed to be the kind of up-and-coming Baffert horse that was going to take their place. He bombed in the Traverse, so they had to drop him aside. Cezanne, he looked like another potential Derby starter, didn't make it there. Actually had to scratch out of the Pat Day Mile on Saturday. And then Thousand Words flips in the paddock, injuring Jimmy Barnes, breaking his wrist. Some crazy quotes from Jimmy Barnes on Sunday about how he wasn't going to say anything. And then he pulled down his shirt and his hand was pointing the wrong way. So he was like, I better say something. Ended up watching the race on the way to the hospital, got surgery. So he sounds like he's doing all right. But just what an interesting route that Baffert took to this Derby. He had seemingly, you know, the race cornered in May. You know, even later in the summer, it seemed to have a really strong hand. And then he was down to one horse. Pretty much everyone had forgotten, and that horse gets it done for him. Huge weekend. We'll get to the Oaks. Toss it to Bill for his impressions on the Derby.
Well, first of all, I'm not the only one wearing the dunce cap here. This was the good horse that nobody liked. I'm not talking about a 50-1 shot that everybody said he has no chance. If you go back and listen to our podcast or look at what everybody was saying, this is a horse that looked like a mile and a quarter was going to be impossible for him based on what he did in the Haskell. And so, you know, what happened from the Haskell where he was two and a half in front turning for home and almost got caught on the wire in a mile and eighth race by New York traffic to what transpired 7 weeks later in the Kentucky Derby. And I think the credit goes to Baffert. And I wrote this afterwards. I mean, it's one thing to win the Kentucky Derby with horses like American Pharoah and Justified. I mean, probably any trainer in the country could have won with them because they were superior horses. I think this really brought out the best in Baffert. He had 7 weeks to figure out how to get this horse to go a mile and a quarter, and he did it. And, you know, again, I don't think that I'm the only one that needs to, you know, have egg on my face right now. I mean, the whole world of handicappers and experts did not like this horse. So, you know, he was better than we thought. He was able to run a mile and a quarter when most people think he couldn't do it. And, you know, hats off to him. Kudos to the whole team and kudos to a good horse who was underrated.
Yeah. And Bill, I will also wear the as it were.
Or props.
Because I was, I think, the only one at the end of the show when we went through all the horses. And I was like, hey, what about this Authentic horse? And we were all like, nah, he's never going to do it. What does he know? He was gasping for air at the Haskell. And so, you know, we're all kind of in the same boat. But, yeah, it was nice to see, you know, Authentic hold off everybody. A couple of takeaways from the race on the jockey side for me. Number one is that Johnny Velasquez actually outrode everybody in that race, you know, coming in from all the way in the outside. And he was patient. He waited for some of the speed to go. He made other jockeys make a decision first. And then he kind of, you know, went on his own. And it was the third Kentucky Derby win for Johnny Velasquez and his 200th Grade One victory. So it couldn't be more fitting that he won his 200th in the Kentucky Derby, which I thought was just really kind of cool from a numbers standpoint. The other jockey that I want to highlight is I was watching very closely our own Paco Lopez in it. And midway through the beginning of the race, like in the first two furlongs, I actually uttered out loud because my wife was laughing at me. I said, what the hell is Paco doing? And, you know, he was basically kind of riding the horse almost like it was a maiden 10 claimer at Monmouth, where he was trying to rush to the front and get out in front of everybody and knocking people over on, you know, on the left and then, you know, kind of situating himself on the right. He did not look like he was of the caliber of the rest of the group. You know, compared to Johnny Velasquez and Saez and Mikey Smith and the rest of the group. But no, listen, Paco's ridden horses and ridden winners for us. But I think it's usually when, you know, when you have a good horse, Paco is great on the front end. When you get to this stage, whether it's the World Series in baseball or the Super Bowl in football or the Kentucky Derby at Churchill Downs, you have to up your game. And some people can do it, like a big money Mike. That's why Mike Smith's called that. And some people, you know, need extra seasoning and need to do it a couple of times before they can get to that level. And that's what my takeaway was from Paco. And again, my friends own part of New York Traffic. So I was very focused on, you know, trying to root Cassius King and LC Racing and those guys home, because it would be a great story and they're good people in the business. And I want, you know, I want good things for Chuck and Chuck Zachney and Glenn Bennett and their teams. So I was very focused on that gray horse. But man, he did not look like he being Paco did not look like he deserved to kind of be in that same kind of group as those riders. And I know part of the reason why is simply because a lot of jockeys opted not to go to Kentucky this weekend. So, you know, I don't blame Paco for taking the shot and for doing it. But I just don't think that he did a great job in that race. And that was my third takeaway. Okay. My fourth takeaway in the race, and I'll let Al have the floor, is that, you know, as a lot of people on social media were talking about, geez, it was the second or third fastest Kentucky Derby ever. Well, you know, again, I want to pump the brakes on that a little bit, because while the timing of it, and Bill, you can jump in on stop on timing and whether or not it was right or not. But on the timing of it, he did finish in 2:03. He went home the last quarter mile in 25:03. So he was kind of dogged at the end. And yeah, it was the second or third, I don't remember, the fastest Kentucky Derby in modern history. But these horses are also much, much further along into their three-year-old years. You know, obviously all the other derbies are in May, and when some of the horses aren't even 36 months old yet and they're racing, versus now their development from, you know, May of their three-year-old year, until September of their three-year-old year is huge. It's a big, big difference. So that part didn't surprise me that the time was so fast and so close to a record. But the fact that they went home in 24:04 and then 25:03 for the last quarter mile, that actually did surprise me. Take it away, Al.
I guess I'm not surprised. I mean, you could turn that argument upside down and say after going a half mile in 46:02 or 46:03, that 25:03 come home time and 2 minutes and change for a mile and a quarter, a distance that we obviously had our question marks. And I think that's probably something that you could turn into a positive for him. So I was against Authentic. I have him in the contest. In full disclosure, I would have, had Maxfield been available for our draft, I would have gone with Maxfield. And John, I think you're a Maxfield fan.
I'll trade you. Fan. You want to trade? I'm into trades.
So I tried to beat Authentic out of the top two as well. I used Honor AP and Tis the Law. I saw them as the only two horses that could win the race because I thought the pace would be genuine. And I also think what happened with Thousand Words had some material effect on the outcome. I'm not a giant Thousand Words fan. He would have added to the pace, I think, from down from where he was starting. And either, I don't know that he was faster than Authentic, and that Authentic might not have beat him to the first turn. He could have been with the pace and maybe hung Authentic out another path heading into that first turn, making his life just slightly more difficult. But I think it's possible as well that the track, which played speedy all weekend and played kind of speed, and speed that was being set in the two path or three path, not at the rail. I think the argument could be made that the track might have helped him a little bit. You know, Tis the Law, I think Tis the Law got probably ahead or neck ahead of Authentic at the 3/16. And then, you know, Joe, like you said, from there, he really didn't have an excuse. So hats off to Authentic. As an RAP fan, that was a difficult watch to see what happened out of the gate, whether you believe that that was an intentional move by Paco or not. And I guess I haven't decided yet. I'd be interested what you guys think. He definitely took a right turn. Now, I don't know if that impacted Mike Smith or RAP and left him flat-footed. Mike said after the race that RAP did not get over the track. I mean, here's a horse that was beaten five lengths in fourth, covering 49 feet more than Authentic, and didn't get over the track. So my pocketbook hurts for that one because I threw all of them underneath Tis the Law and Honor AP in the triple. So But listen, great to have a derby. Great call by Travis Stone. And, you know, derby's in the books. And great job by Baffert. I agree with you, Bob. I think, Bob. You know, Baffert pulled a Mandela or a Ron McAnally and worked this horse 6 and 7 and a mile of all things. And it worked. So hats off.
Yeah, I mentioned that last week when we were talking about him, that it kind of seemed like he wasn't 100% convinced that the horse could go a mile and a quarter with the way he was working them. But because he knew what he was doing, because it didn't seem like that it was a problem for him in the stretch. I just, in general, I hate the he didn't handle the track excuse. Like, it's just so easy, and it's just the jockey can just say it, and there's no like empirical proof of it whatsoever. I get it if the horse like got beat 30 lengths or whatever, and you say they hated the track or sloppy or something, but horse ran as well as Tis the Law and Honor AP did. I don't want to hear about how they didn't like the track. All right, so what looked like a runaway victory for me in the three-year-old fantasy contest just a couple of weeks ago is now neck and neck, because Al, who didn't like Authentic going to the Derby, nevertheless gets the 300 points for him and got the 100 from the Haskell. So you better start liking him real soon, Al. Right. So here's where we are. So I got 120 for Tis the Law running second. So I'm at 530 points right now. Al got 300 for Authentic. He's at 528. So 2 points difference. Brian's been left behind a little bit. He's at 315. Bill's got 85 still. And John just couldn't quite get out of the toilet. Got 60 points for the big run from Mr. Big News, but is still 5 points behind Bill in last place. So we have one more race on the schedule for the contest, which is the Preakness, October 3rd. 150 points to the winner, 60 to second, 30 to third, 15 to fourth. I feel reasonably good if Tis the Law and Art Collector both make it there, but obviously anything can happen. But it's good to see somebody up in my level, Al, finally during this whole contest. So we'll, unless you guys have any more Derby thoughts, I'm happy to move on to the Oaks, which was a fascinating race in its own right as well. Gamine, I thought, was honestly the biggest disappointment of the entire weekend, because the pace that she got away with. Now, maybe she was going too slow. There are certain speed horses when, you know, they go 48 or 112 or whatever. They, for some reason, they're not into it the way they are when they go 46, 109, try to bottom out the field. But she was supposed to win that race. And, you know, no disrespect to She Dares the Devil. I thought, you know, this is after the race. This is a post-race opinion. But I thought she was an overlay at 14 to 1. You know, I thought there were two second tier contenders, her and Donna Veloce. Of course, I went with Donna Veloce, who stunk. But she ran great. So did Swiss Skydiver. But Gamine, I thought, was a super disappointment. And it kind of ties into the nature of the year for Baffert. He had that one final disappointment with Gamine, who I'm sure he was expecting much better out of. And you know, she didn't get the job done. Didn't really come close. Didn't switch leads until like the eighth pole. So I thought that was, she's a little nuts. I think she's always tugging one way or the other. And just, I don't know. She's super talented. Obviously, if you can get her out on the lead in a one turn race, she's brilliant. Probably, I don't know, may go favorite in the filly and mare sprint if that's where she ends up, but she's not quite a finished product. And I don't know if she'll ever be. And she's just really disappointed over the weekend. Some other really good performances we'll get to, but I just wanted to get some quick thoughts from you guys on the Oaks.
Well, Joe, you don't want to spend another 10 minutes talking about Paco Lopez?
I didn't have that on the rundown. Maybe okay. I should factor in a Paco Lopez segment every week for John.
Yes, who did he ride in the Oaks? I don't think he had a mount. I agree with pretty much everything you said about the Oaks, but I was extremely disappointed just by the whole race. And I was the guy, I got into it because I was doing the Road to the Oaks with the TDN. So I was following these horses all along. And I thought this had a chance to be the most scintillating race we've seen in a long time between two superstars. And, you know, I'm not taking anything away from She Dares the Devil. She ran great. She won the race. But, you know, a victory for her just wasn't the script we were looking for in the storylines. So a couple things to talk about. First of all, the reason why she won was probably Brad Cox. I mean, this guy was just insanely hot over this weekend. His horses, I mean, Bo Recall beats Newspaper of Record. That's not supposed to happen either. His horse is just running through their skin. And, you know, he's good with everything, but with three-year-old fillies, he's just outstanding. On Gamine, I think we found out that she doesn't want to go a mile and eighth. You know, could she have won? Yes. Was she disappointing? Yes. Did she run her best race? No. But, you know, there was that whole buildup, just like, you know, Authentic can't go a mile and a quarter. We were wrong. A lot of people said Gamine really doesn't want to go a mile and eighth. And people that are saying that were technically right. Now, she doesn't want to go the distance. You're right. I think the Breeders' Cup Filly and Mare Sprint will be where she'll wind up, and she'll be very, very tough there. But I still can't figure out how She Dares the Devil beat Swiss Skydiver, who we knew could go the distance. She ran a race. You know, it's just one of those things you shrug your shoulders and move on. But, you know, just because, not to knock any horse, knock She Dares the Devil, just because I was so up for that race, it just kind of went over the, you know, all right, you know, why did this happen? Let's turn the page. Maybe the Derby will be fun tomorrow. And maybe Paco Lopez will impede 17 horses so we can talk about it.
Yeah, and you have to, again, give credit to She Dares the Devil coming in from the Indiana Oaks, you know, which she crushed the field there, and including Baroness and a couple of the horses that ended up running in the Kentucky Oaks. And then, you know, Brad Cox did a great job of getting her ready and getting her to peak in a lifetime best buyer number. She went from an 83 in an allowance race at Churchill to an 86 buyer at the Indiana Oaks, and then a 101 to win the Kentucky Oaks, which is a huge jump. But credit to him for getting the filly to that point. Gamine, in watching her run, reminds me of like Bellafina, where she's just a really top athlete, you know, bigger, stronger than the rest of the group, but she just can't get that extra eighth of a mile, and maybe better off turning back to run in the Breeders' Cup, you know, sprint, like you mentioned, Bill, or some of the big grade one sprints. You know, for fillies that are out in California later on. Because, I mean, Bellafina has carved out a nice career making $1.6, $1.7 million, you know, running in a lot of those 7/8 and one turn mile, six furlong kind of races. So the future is still bright, I think, for Gamine. But I was also equally impressed that, of course, this happens in the business. You know, Daredevil, who is not heard of for a while and then you know, gets kind of, you know, sent off. Now he's got horses that finish 1-2 in the Kentucky Oaks, which is just incredible if you think about it, that a stallion actually has horses that finish first and second in the Oaks in any year, let alone in a crazy year like this. So overall, yeah, it was disappointing. Gamine didn't run well. You have to take your hat off to She Dares the Devil. And Swiss Skydiver, you know, man, that filly, she just runs hard every single race, no matter where they run her, no matter what distance they run her, against boys, girls, you know, shorter, longer, a mile and a quarter, a mile and an eighth. You know, on the East Coast, West Coast, and everywhere in between. And, you know, to run second in the Oaks, you shouldn't hang your head, because that's still a really, really outstanding finish. Is it the finish that McPeak and his team wanted her to end up? No, but she's still going to have a lot of racing left in her between now and the end of the year and still have a shot at ringing the bell, you know, albeit a tougher ask against older mares, but in the handicap division there.
Yeah, let's give credit to Brad Cox. His 2 Oaks in 3 years with Monomoy Girl 2 years ago. And let's also not forget that Brad Cox lost what might have been a top Oaks contender in Taraz earlier this year to a tragic injury. So Bonnie South could have represented the stable for Judmont. She kind of picked up the torch for Judmont after Taraz's passing, but she didn't make the Oaks. So listen, great training job. She's a filly. I agreed entirely with your analysis in the Oaks preview. I didn't see her bridging the gap. I mean, she had 15 points, if not more than that, to make up on Gamine and Swiss Skydiver. I thought Speech made sense as an alternative, and she kind of got left and then never really picked up her feet either. So I think Gamine is definitely a turn back candidate. And in that vein, I think the Breeders' Cup Filly and Mare Sprint could be one of the races of Breeders' Cup weekend with her, Serengeti Empress. Could you imagine those two ding-donging it on the front end, toss in a little Mia Mischief, and then for me, toss in Bell's the One. I think that's going to be one of the races of the first weekend of November. So, yeah, a bit disappointing, a bit anticlimactic in the Oaks, but it, you know, sometimes those are the better stories.
And Alan, you mentioned, you know, Bell's the one, and I know you have a personal connection with the trainer there, but I have to admit that I was rooting hard for Serengeti Empress to get up there. And no offense to Neil, who's the trainer of Bell's the One, but man, I was yelling, screaming, and I have no skin in the game on that race whatsoever, but what a great race that ended up being, the Derby City Distaff, between those two top fillies, Bell's the One and Serengeti Empress.
And I got to say, like, I would take Serengeti Empress over Gamine in a head-to-head because the fractions that she puts up are just crazy. To be running 43 and three halves and still have something left.
And went away for six furlongs too, Joe. It was amazing. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah. So I would take her over Gamine. I think Gamine, you know, she's used to more running like 22:45. That's not going to cut it against Serengeti Empress. She's a beast going one turn for sure. So it wasn't just the Derby and the Oaks. There were a lot of performances that were worth mentioning over the weekend, Labor Day weekend, really the close of the summer racing season, as well as the summer season in general. It's not just racing, but I'll go through the Derby and Oaks Day undercard races that I think are worth mentioning. Monomoy Girl, obviously, we got to see whether John thinks she's back or not. The 97 buyer wasn't the greatest La Troyenne I've ever seen. Kind of disappointing efforts from Vexatious and Horologist. Digital Age had a big win in the Turf Classic. I know Al's a fan of his. Bill mentioned Beau Recall. Otherwise, Sharing, it's so great to see Sharing back. She's a really cool horse. She's not, you know, she's not a generational talent in terms of speed figures yet, but just to go and run as well as she did at Royal Ascot, where it was a race where you want to talk about a horse that didn't get over the track. I thought she looked super uncomfortable in the Coronation and still ran a good second to Alpine Star, who got that perfect trip. Came back, won the Edgewood on Friday at Churchill. So that was super exciting to see her. She was a rising star that I made, so I have that kind of a little bit of a connection to her as well. Racing at Saratoga, Jackie's Warrior in the hopeful was just super dominant. Stopped the clock in 1:21 and change. I mean, track at Saratoga has been playing very fast the last couple of weeks, like faster than I've ever seen it play, but still 1:21 is real running, no matter how fast the track is. Vequist the day before, in the spin away. I thought it was interesting. Princess Nora then won the Del Mar debutante. She was crazy impressive on Sunday. I thought it was interesting that First Crop Sires swept the two juvenile filly grade ones with Nyquist in the spin away and then Not This Time in the Del Mar debutante. Princess Nora, I think, is interesting where she only got a 79 buyer, but she really hasn't been allowed to run either of her two races, like the first race especially. She was just like never really was asked to run, did everything on her own. And then Sunday did, you know, was asked a little bit, but, you know, for the most of the final film she was wrapped up on. So it'll be interesting to see how good she is when she faces a little better competition. A couple interesting turf performances I wanted to mention. Flavius in the Tourist Mile yesterday at Kentucky Downs had a big late punch for Chad Brown and Judmont got a 103 buyer. And then I wanted to mention, I mentioned him before in the Keeneland bit, but Analyze It, who we hadn't seen since he ran in the 2018 Breeders' Cup Mile. I was always trying to figure out where he was. Came back in the Red Bank Stakes. Our headquarters are in Red Bank at TDN, so Alice always made the joke that we should present the trophy, which I think would be great in a normal year. But yes, so it was good to see him back. He got 100 buyer. Obviously not a great field, still a grade three, but good to see him back, and he could be an interesting turf miler going forward. But those are just some of the performances that caught my eye this weekend. Obviously, the juveniles, other than the Derby and the Oaks, were the big story. I wonder if there's anything else that caught you guys' eye or anything that I said that you want to follow up on.
Basically, I'm just going to jump in on Monomoy Girl because I thought that was a really impressive race in the La Troyenne, you know, the grade one in a deep, deep field. And you know, it's nice. It's really good to see the filly back. I know you guys poke fun at me about the tobacco meter and everything like that, but the bottom line is that I never had anything against the filly. You know, it was just that silliness of sending the fresh release out. But that being said, the filly herself has come back into dominant form, and it looks like that she's really getting into, she got the rust off the first race. She won, you know, the second race impressively, and then the La Troyenne against a deeper field and a real competition. She just put them away. So she is trending positive towards the Breeders' Cup.
This is no fun. I wanted the feud to keep going until we got a bare knuckle boxing match between you and Brad.
I have no ill will towards the owners of the trainer of the horse, or the horse for that matter. So, you know, that being said, the Euros came out in strong force this weekend at Churchill and really anywhere where there was a turf race. There were Euros that were winning it. Digital Age, you mentioned. Rock and Emperor ran third, and Sacred Life ran fourth in the Bourbon Turf Grade One. And then there was another race I can't remember right now, but the first three horses finished 1, 2, 3 in a Grade Two as well, and they were all from Europe. So it's interesting to see them come here and continue to dominate the fields, especially on the turf races. Joey, I think you did a great job mentioning two first year stallions, Not This Time and Nyquist, and how their graduates, their progeny are graduating in a big way. I give a lot of credit to Vequist, who won just well in hand by 9.5, 10 lengths in the Spinaway. That was an impressive race. And it looks like that, she's continuing to progress and may be able to handle a little bit further ground. But overall, I thought it was just a great weekend of racing. And I was glued to the TV for most of the weekend with regard to watching all of these graded races. And this is what we've been starving for. This is what we were clamoring for in March, April, May, and just begging for some of these races to come together. And now the fields are really tight. They're really running well. And these horses are, the top horses are rising to the, to the cream of the crop and the top of the their respective, divisions. So I'm excited about it. I know last week I was like a kid in a candy store, bouncing off the walls in anticipation of this weekend. And overall, I thought that the races were very good. I was also, always in the back of my mind these days, I'm always thinking, okay, please don't have a national televised breakdown. And I think that all of the protocols that have gone into place for safety for the animals and making sure the athletes are sound, overall was really, really good. So again, we don't talk about that enough, except when it's a bad thing. But it was just great to see that everyone started and finished, except for at Kentucky Downs, where a couple of horses didn't get the start. But that's neither here nor there, because Kentucky Downs actually did the right thing. I don't know if you guys saw this, but they had a race where two of the horses the gates didn't open. So they ended up giving everybody $5,000, everyone who participated in the race, $5,000 for starting. And they gave jockey fees, I think, of $500 as well. So kudos to Kentucky Downs, for that meet and for that feat, I should say.
They always do everything right. They do things right.
They really, yeah, really do. And we're actually running another miracle there this weekend, coming up in a big, I mean, every stake race there is a big race money wise. But that being said, if they did the absolute right thing, because can you imagine if that happened at a different racetrack where, the gate didn't open for two of the horses, they would have said, oh, well, those horses were non-competitors and therefore you'll get your wagers back. But what about for the owners and the jockeys and the trainers? So again, congratulations to Kentucky Downs for handling that and getting in front of it before it, before it became an issue. Sorry, Al, go ahead.
Oh, that's cool. Just in a generic sense, I run this list in the paper every, usually every Tuesday, but today because of the holiday racing, but if you look at the list of new stakes winners for sires, you'll see like 5 Sons of Giants Causeway sired winners this week, including freshman Brody's Cause and Not This Time. So I think that's a good good sign for a horse that some have always questioned whether he's going to be a sire of sires, but Brody's Cause and Not This Time could sort of fly that flag. And then Uncle Mo has, obviously, he's a fairly young stallion. He's got a few first crop sires out there, but all in the last week, Labond, Outwork, and Nyquist all had stakes winners, and in the same vein, real promising start for him as a sire of sires. So just wanted to add that in.
And now Labond, I think if I remember correctly, his horse that won a stake race, it was, even though he's a New York stallion, it was an open stake race, right? It wasn't like it was a New York bred race.
His horse won the PG Johnson.
Right.
On the turf. It was off the turf,
but she looked really good. She got an 81 buyer for Kenwick Peak. We talked last year about the star-studded freshman class that we had last year, freshman sires. This year's looking pretty good too so far, with Not This Time, Nyquist, you got a handful of other stallions that are off to good starts, like Upstart, Outwork, like Al mentioned. So I think don't sleep on this year's freshman class as well. I think they may turn out to be a pretty good class. And just to jump back to the Kentucky Downs thing real quick, because somebody saw some people complaining that the race was declared no contest, because I get it. Like, if you had the try or whatever in that race, like, you feel like you're kind of screwed. But you have to think that the two horses who didn't get in the gate would affect the race in some way, whether it's the pace, whether it's traffic. Like, you just, you can't call that the race if it didn't have all the horses in the gate. So it sucks if you feel like you got screwed out of a winning bet there, but that's the right call to make in every case, I think there. So yeah, good job by Kentucky Downs. Not good job getting him in the gate, but everything that happened after that, the good job by them. They do right by people. I think that's why they have such a popular meet in addition to the big purses, obviously. Owning multiple graded stakes winning racehorses like Hard Not to Love and Decorated Invader is attainable with a racing partnership like West Point Thoroughbreds. Partnerships enable you to spread your ownership across several horses for less than it costs to own one horse alone. This increases your racetrack action and chances for a big horse. Learn more about why West Point Thoroughbreds is the gold standard in racing partnerships at westpointtb.com. So West Point closed the book on one Kentucky Derby with winning impression on Saturday, and then their dreams danced on to 2021. In the Run for the Roses with a little nudge from Arabian Prince, 2-year-old colt. He began his career with a sharp win at Churchill Downs last Wednesday, also for trainer Dallas Stewart. Arabian Prince was a yearling purchase last year, and they're on the prowl again, Kingland September, as we've spoken about, starting this Sunday. And that's the sale where they've really kind of made their bones with Decorated Invader, Rig Weekend, Untamed Domain, Hard Not to Love, Giza Goddess, Caressa, Just Whistle Dixie, and Burn. So they've definitely cleaned up at that sale in the past and figure to do so again. So best of luck in the 2021 Derby. We'll be keeping an eye on the 2-year-olds for West Point, and best of luck at the sale, guys. So we have a little bit of news this morning. It's been a pretty light news week, and aside from the Derby and the Oaks, but Ahmed Zayat has reportedly filed for bankruptcy. This was reported by T.D. Thornton in the TDN. This was kind of an ongoing story with him, that he's had these liabilities to trainers all across the industry, had to liquidate a lot of horses last year. Just a guy that is kind of notorious for not paying his bills. And this is kind of coming home to roost for him right now. And it's a major fall from grace for me. That's my impression on it. You know, I remember back in, maybe it was like 2005, 2006, somewhere in the mid 2000s. And he just burst onto the scene at Saratoga and a bunch of horses with Bill Mott. And I kept seeing these light blue silks with the Z's on them winning every race and so many 2-year-old races. There was one summer at Saratoga where he just killed it. And I was like, who is this guy? Who is this guy? Lo and behold, a couple of years later, he ends up with American Pharoah, winning the first Triple Crown in 37 years. You would think that that would set you up for life, to have the first Triple Crown winner in 37 years, have a massive stud deal for him. But obviously that wasn't the case. It's sad, honestly, because I think overall, I mean, I don't know Ahmed Zayat or any of the Zayats at all, but it seemed like, you know, their heart was in the right place in terms of, you know, having the horses run, you know, investing in the business. I didn't think that he seemed like an outwardly bad guy, or they seemed like an outwardly bad family. They seemed to, you know, really care about the sport and be passionate about it. So it sucks. I mean, I'm not going to like take any pleasure in somebody going belly up like that, but it's a crazy story to have the first Triple Crown winner in 37 years, and then 5 years later, you're filing for bankruptcy. I mean, there's a lot more in the story, a lot more details about who he owes money specifically to, but it's a sad story, man. That's my main takeaway.
Yeah, I mean, Joe, you're right. I mean, the first thing you think of, this is not a guy who wasn't winning any races or was not making any money. You know, when you take the earnings of American Pharoah plus the stud deal, you know, what does that add up to? How many millions and millions of dollars? And still this happens. And, you know, none of this is any sort of surprise. I mean, everybody knew the financial problems he was having. It was well documented with the legal proceedings from that investment banking group that had lent him money. But you look at this, and this is right out of TD's story. The thing that really jumps off the page is the trainers who are left holding the bag for money that he owes. And I just see Bob Baffert, $227,000. Red Cox, $194,000. Richard Baltus, $316,000. Rudy Rodriguez, $394,000. Todd Fletcher, $125,000. Those are all the debts that he is owed to these trainers. And, you know, most of these guys are doing very well in life financially. But still, I mean, to get stiffed out of $200,000 bucks, thing for anybody. And, you know, I mean, guess they knew what they were getting into with Zayat's reputation. So I don't know how much you feel sorry for him. But nonetheless, I mean, that's a tough pill to swallow. And, you know, John Green is the expert on this sort of thing so far as finances and taxes and maybe bankruptcy and everything. So maybe he can explain that. But, you know, they'll see pennies on the dollar. And you know, that's got to be something for every single one of those trainers. It's got to be a pretty leave a pretty bad taste in their mouth.
Yeah, and Bill, you're right. I mean, TD Thurton does a great job of identifying all the people that are, you know, or the prominent people, I should say, that are owed money in the 140-something page legal proceeding. So, you know, you give him credit for going through and coming up with the information. But I feel bad, you know, not only for the trainers, but also for some of these businesses. I mean, Brookledge is owed $164,000. Hager Davidson and some of the major, you know, vet clinics in the country are each owed over $200,000. So, you know, it does make an impact from a competitive, you know, balance standpoint. You say, all right, well, why is he winning all these races? He's got the top trainers. He's got the, you know, the best bloodstock, you know, agents out there and some really good horse flesh. But also, if you're not paying your bills, you have a competitive advantage over people who are paying their bills and can't buy the next horse or, you know, or have an opportunity to buy a couple of horses more and kind of get their inventory going. So it's not a great situation. You know, again, we can't take pleasure in this at all because it's somebody's shortcomings that are just, you know, now open for business that everyone can see all the information on. It's not a great look for the industry because here was somebody that as recently as on Saturday, you know, when they did a piece on American Pharoah, they did a NBC, I don't know if you saw it, did a wonderful job on, you know, following American Pharoah and their foals as they came old enough to run and then ultimately, you know, run in the Breeders' Cup races. And Ahmed and his son, Justin, were front and center on that, you know, on that documentary. And they were very polished and they did a great job and they had some great answers. And you could feel their genuineness of how much they love the horse and how much they love the sport. So it is sad that a prominent group like the Zayat family is now, you know, in this kind of a situation. But, you know, I feel bad for the vendors more so than I do for the family.
John, I think we got to make mention that's a bad job by NBC. And they put out this warm and fuzzy story about Ahmed Zayat. And granted, this latest bankruptcy thing didn't come out till afterwards. But, you know, how do you tell that story without going into the details of the, you know, unseemly or messy side of everything that's been going on? And, you know, I know that it's not meant to be 60 minutes and a hard hitting piece and everything, but, you know, for racing insiders to know the backstory of everything that's going on. And, you know, that is really ignored in this piece by NBC. I think, you know, look, they do a really good job with their horse racing coverage as a whole. But I thought this feature, you know, lacking any discussion of something that's very pertinent part of the American Pharoah story, definitely is a bad job by them.
You know, in addition to American Pharoah, let's not forget that Zayat's raced the likes of his sire, Pioneer of the Nile, who's unfortunately passed away since, but Painter, and there's that whole story with Painter and the founder and overcoming that, Bodie Meister, and then he's had several good race fillies, Jay-Z Warrior and Hart Ashley, and so those were valuable assets as well at a time. So, yeah, I mean, it really is, you know, for a high class operation. You know, it really is sad to see its demise, you know?
It's one of those things where I agree that it doesn't reflect well on racing that he was able to run up these debts with so many different people, despite his reputation for not paying bills. And it's just, there's so much in the industry where as long as the money keeps churning in, people don't really care where it comes from. Like I think of Phoenix Thoroughbreds a little bit. You know, there was that big scandal with them and supposedly, allegedly, you know, there was a sham cryptocurrency that was started by the owner of Phoenix Thoroughbreds. And it seemed for a little bit like, okay, well, that was going to be it for them and the business. And now they're, you know, winning grade one races and running all over the place and have all these like really good looking horses. I mean, maybe that they're, you know, once that gets completely adjudicated, it'll be different. But there's too much in racing where, you know, as long as people are spending money, you don't care where it comes from. You don't care where it's borrowed from. You don't care where it's, you know, allegedly stolen from. It's, I don't know. I get that we need owners, but it's just for Zayat to be able to rack up six figures in debt with so many different people. It's like, how was how was this not nipped in the bud earlier on by somebody somewhere? And so that's, we got to do a better job of that. That's the weekly we have to do a better job corner right there for racing. Can't be a show without it. Joining the West Point Thoroughbreds partnership can vault you into the world of instant camaraderie among people surrounding high-class horses and stakes action for a fraction of the cost of trying to do it on your own. Learn more at westpointtb.com. The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. With over 500 clients in the horse business, they have proven strategies to save you taxes. Learn more about how they can help you at www.greenco.com. Our Green Group Guest of the Week this week is the founder of My Racehorse, whose silks were carried to the winner's circle in Saturday's Kentucky Derby by Authentic, Michael Behrens. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, glad to be here. Thanks. That sounded good, though. You can say that again if you want.
You can't ask for a better intro than that. So let's start with the basics. Can you tell us the genesis and the inspiration for creating My Racehorse, and then I guess kind of the Cliff Notes version of how you saw enough proof of concept to go after a big horse like Authentic?
Yeah, no, great question. So, I am not from the racing world. I've been in ad tech and marketing my whole career. Growing up in Southern California, San Diego was like 15 minutes away. And that's where we went to decompress after crazy stressful weeks, you know, go out with the friends, have a couple of drinks, maybe a burger, and bet a few races. And I just loved it as a sport, as a form of entertainment. But then professionally was running an ad agency, eventually worked in some e-commerce for a company called Casper. It sold mattresses in a box. I was a CMO over there, but always very intrigued about kind of what drives the sport, how we can get more fan engagement. Started kind of looking around, talking to people, and just came up with this concept that people who really were energized, really excited about our sport were those that had some kind of interest in ownership, either through friends or a partnership, whatever it may be. And I just felt like that was like where we could scale, we could get trial, we could get kind of mass adoption to appreciate the sport. And I kind of started meeting some people, and people started telling me a little bit about some of the challenges that we would face in doing an idea like that. So we started in California, and we got the state of California to grant us a permit to do it only there under like a pilot program, and it went really well. And that was kind of the genesis that got us excited. We saw the amount of people who were enjoying the product that were signed up, and kind of then we went national just July of last year. That was it. So it's been a short window that we've actually been out of our pilot and been live.
Hey, Michael, it's Bill Finley, and thanks for joining us. And let's continue with that story about the history of MyRacehorse.com, et cetera. Obviously, a big part of your success has been Spendthrift Farms. Many of your horses, I believe it's about 50%, have some involvement with Spendthrift. Obviously, Authentic was a Spendthrift horse. So how did that relationship with Spendthrift and Wayne Hughes come to be?
Yeah, so when I wrote the original business plan for this, I looked at the industry to try to figure out who had the personality, the DNA, and B. Wayne Hughes, with his success in business and his innovation with breeding, I just loved his disruptive nature. I actually used to do marketing for Public Storage, one of his companies. And so when the business kind of came to fruition, I basically called up Spendthrift and talked to Ned and said, can I have a meeting with B. Wayne Hughes? And he said, nope, but you can meet with me. So I came out and I kind of took him through the idea. And the next day, Mr. Hughes called me back in and we started talking, and he just loved it. He wants the sport to continue to thrive and grow, loved the concept. And we started partnering a couple of deals, and that relationship has only gotten stronger and stronger over time. And now, you know, Mr. Hughes has come in as one of our partners. So our relationship with Spendthrift is vital. Our relationship with Mr. Hughes has been critical.
Yeah, and Michael, it's Jonathan Green. Welcome to the industry in a big way with the Kentucky Derby win. That's fantastic. You know, we try to help out also here on the East Coast with encouraging people to be in the business, you know, through the Empire Racing Club and some other organizations like that. You've been successful in getting over 4,000 investors just in the Kentucky Derby winner alone. At what point in time do you feel like you're going to hit critical mass where it's just going to be so many people involved, and that's a good problem to have, but so many people getting involved in the industry. And at that point, do you step up and buy more expensive horses, or do you kind of keep with the current business plan that you have?
Yeah, great question. So kind of a couple things to unpack there. I think, and actually just for clarification, I was quoted in the press conference of saying it was 4,600 because when I got to the track that morning, I saw the cap tables at 45. I saw a lot of people buying in. The official was 5,314 by post time. We actually had to shut 10 people off while they were in the gate. But anyways, so that was authentic as 5,314 unique owners. And I think we're really getting very close to that point of critical mass. The viral coefficient, the network effects are starting to take over. And we're seeing real scale happen because you have so many brand ambassadors. I mean, there's so much excitement that's going on. And think about 5,314 people for one horse, and they all have their own social networks. And they were all posting their winner circle pictures. They were posting their videos. And we obsess internally about a concept called viral coefficient, which is how do we make this product where it gets into social networks and it kind of goes into family and friends that we would never see, right? We're not part of their networks. We're not on their Facebook groups. And that's exactly what happened. And then the halo that we saw from the last couple of days, you can only imagine, but we have been seeing it for a while because we penetrated so many households, because it's so easy to spread the word. So we're getting very close. We're having, it doesn't seem like there's anything that's slowing down. There's no deceleration to our growth rate. It's actually exponentially growing. So it's not like there was a bunch of early adopters that said, hey, I've always wanted to do this, and you know, let's check it off the list and we're done. It's the opposite. As more credibility is being established, partnerships with, you know, B. Wayne Hughes and Spendthrift don't hurt, win the Kentucky Derby doesn't hurt. But you're really seeing that viral coefficient, that halo take off. And I think we've spent actually the last 48 hours talking so much about your question, which is like, we have a major responsibility now to say this industry is going to have 100,000 microshare owners before we know it, right? If you just look at the trajectory, the US is now going to have 100,000, it's inevitable. And we have a responsibility to be a steward of that, to figure out how we navigate with the tracks and with the sales auctions. And I mean, every part of this industry now has to deal with the fact that a brand new player that brings in a lot of capital, which is the fan base, is now here, and they're here in a big way, and they're going to have an impact in all aspects of this business.
Hey, Michael, Alan Carrasso, thanks for being here. I'm curious, just what is the goal of My Racehorse? Hey, different kind of theories floating around social media, and I'm sure you saw some of the uproar and the back and forth, but what is your intention? Is your intention to try to grow thoroughbred ownership? You just want people to pay a couple hundred dollars and have the right to claim that they own a piece of a Kentucky Derby winner? What do you see as the objective?
I mean, for us, our idea was to give people the thrills and the excitement of ownership without obviously the financial, you know, burdens that normally come with it, right? So we made the minimum super low. One of the things that a lot of people don't realize is how many people come in a much more significant way. How many people have 10 horses? How many have built 15 horses? How many people on average will spend $4,000, $5,000, or $10,000 per horse? The idea was just to keep the minimums low and allow you to come in what makes you feel good, do it in a transparent world in a way. So all of our disclosures, all of our documentation is there. And I felt I sold my last company, right? So just give you a little context. And I wanted to come into ownership. And what I was turned off by was how opaque it was, right? Like I couldn't understand exactly what I was paying for, what was being bundled, what wasn't being unbundled. There's a lot of, you know, costs and different fees that were going into it. And I didn't understand it. I didn't feel comfortable with it. And I think that transparency is the greatest catalyst to scale. And if we want mass adoption, if we want hundreds of thousands of people to be participatory with the sport through the lens of ownership, the only way it's going to happen is through just full disclosure, full transparency. So that will cause some friction along the way because it's never been done before. We're going to basically show people how difficult the game is sometimes to make money. We're going to show people how expensive it is, potentially have horses. We're going to talk about how many times a horse basically is purchased at a yearling sale, never actually gets to the track. So all that's going to come to fruition. But I think all that is actually what makes the sport so unique and fun and challenging and exciting. And the goal is to get just a real mass adoption, make ownership as transparent as possible, bring people into the sport in a trial capacity, and then allow them to go into different places We have a lot of people who've already gone off and bought on their own horses already. This is not just a socioeconomic. They come in, they get the transparency, they understand what the costs are. They start understanding that how fragile these animals are and how often they, you know, to be, you know, right by the horse, how often they need to be turned out. The care that goes on from the vet side. Like, they come out after a year really educated, which I think is great. You know, empowerment and education is then what drives people to feel confident to allocate capital to anything, right? And if we want people allocating capital to our industry, they've got to understand all the nuances. They've got to understand all the details. And going through a low price point product that is real ownership. And I saw some chatter out there that it's not real. It's nonprofit, whatever it is. I mean, it is not the case. It is a fully qualified security. You basically buy this, you are along for the ride as if you had basically went there and signed title, right? And there's a few things that we do to make it a little bit easier. We don't require cap calls, things like that. But there is no, this is not a derivative product. This is a product that of real equity. And I think through education will come empowerment. I think through empowerment will come capital and enthusiasm. And that's what we're hoping for. And they'll come at all levels of the game.
So I wanted to try to hammer down the specific financials because obviously you don't want to say exactly what the price point was for Authentic, but I'm just trying to get a kind of sense because you bought 12.5% is what I read from Bill's story with you. You have about 4,700 micro shares that you sold. What is like the basic level of investment for a horse and basic level of return for a horse as successful as Authentic?
Yeah, so I have no problem. I mean, we post everything, all financials. Every one of our documents is with the SEC. It's public information. So I have no problem sharing all the details of it. So this horse, we purchased this horse in June, right? This was a made horse. We're not the ones that bought this horse at the sale for $300,000. That was SF Bloodstock that wound up picking up that horse. So we had been buying a lot of younger horses and giving people the hope that maybe you'll find your star, right? That's fun. It's the high beta world. But also there's a lot of disappointment in that world. We all know the numbers of how few yearlings actually wind up entering into the Kentucky Derby starting gate. And so, you know, buying into expensive horses at that stage in their career, it's a tough financial play unless you feel like you can make money in the breeding shed. And so with our relationship with Spendthrift, with their track record and their success of buying stallions, we thought they are absolutely the right partner to take this kind of high risk, high reward swing with. So people bought into Authentic. We bought 12.5%, which we made 12,500 shares available, right? So that everybody knew exactly what kind of equity they're getting, right? They're getting 0.001%. So you know your equity, right? That sounds like a small number to a lot of people. Go to the stock market, look at what you're buying when you buy a share of Google, add a few more zeros to it, right? The idea is that it's okay to come in with low amounts. I just need to know what percentage I have. I need to know exactly what the unit economics are, and then I can decide if I want to buy 10, 50, 100, or just one. So they came in for 206. That's on a $15.2 million valuation that we paid for the horse. That's what Spendthrift paid for the horse for their 87.5%. That's what we paid for our 12.5. No markups by them. We're paying the same deal. So our guy that came in, Mr. Hughes basically paid for, that's what that microshare owner was paying for. But they also did pay for our fee. So we charge 15% to do what we do. So that's kind of the real difference, is that we charge a fee to basically take it to one share down to 12,500, put the platform together, do that diligence, get it qualified by the SEC, and then, you know, push it out through our app and provide that management service. But if you break down the share price, you'll see the 206 was derived at $15 million valuation, mortality insurance, first year stallion insurance. I mean, that's pretty expensive. A lot of people don't appreciate how expensive, you know, fertility and first year stallion insurance can be. And then basically some money for nomination fees to kind of make sure we had that. And then our fee, and that was it. And so there's not much difference when you break down the math, and happy anybody to go look at that in terms of what was paid by the person who bought 88% and what was the person that was paid by bought 0.001%. Now, the question then becomes, well, how much money did they make? We don't buy a horse for $15 million and expect to be making money on the racetrack, right? You expect that horse to be the best son of Into Mischief and to go to Spendthrift Farms and stand and be able to demand high quality, you know, good quality stud fees, breed to great mares, and produce on the track. And that's where a lot of money in this game you know, comes to fruition, right? That's where it manifests itself in that shed. And all 12,500 people, well, 5,000 people, because people bought multiple shares, right, are participatory in the racing and the breeding. So after each season, based on mares covered, live foal rates, all that, do your reconciliations. And just like you would in any corporation, you redistribute the money pro rata back to the shareholders who came in. And that's what they'll see returned on this horse. On most other horses, we buy the horse, we sell the horse, we liquidate the company, we pay people back, they make money along, or they get their dividends along the way. But we're not usually trying to stay on the stallion. This was someone to do something really different that Spendthrift said, this will be the best son of Into Mischief. This is the mile and a quarter horse. That was their commitment from day one when they called us. We think this will be the Into Mischief that gets the mile and a quarter. And we think he's going to be a great racing prospect, but even a better stallion. And we said, let's go for it. We're in. We think the crowd will love it. We love the commitment, the diligence, the thoughtfulness that went into it. And that's how that deal came to fruition.
Hey, Michael, I want to stay on the same subject and sort of the dollars and cents and how this all works. As you well know, because I think MyRacehorse.com actually reacted to this and put out a statement. There was a lot of, uproar is not the right word, but a lot of questions being asked on social media after the Derby. So the horse wins the Kentucky Derby. That's $1.8 million for the owners. A lot of people got out their calculators and said, oh, gee, I'm going to get a check in the mail for whatever, fill in the blank for my share of 0.001%. In actuality, the people, shareholders, the micro share owners are not going to see any money right now from the victory. And could you explain how that all worked and explain to people how these kickers are, the bonus schemes that are involved with most race horses when they change hands about, you know, if they win this race, there's so much is paid, et cetera, et cetera. So you know exactly where I'm coming from. If you could just explain the situation and why maybe there was a misunderstanding among some people who did think there was going to be a check in the mail coming their way.
Of the 5,314, we saw very, very few of those people that were participating in the chatter. A lot of the people this was a big moment. So they came in uneducated and they wanted to look at it and they made some assumptions. But if you watch the people who were participatory, these financials were disclosed. There was emails and FAQs going out about the financials behind this, because the financials behind this weren't straightforward, right? The reality was, you don't buy SF Bloodstock. Owners of high quality horses don't give up on their horses without basically being participatory if those horses go on to success in the racetrack. Many deals that are sold when you're buying the top horses to get into the shed come with performance bonuses back to the original owner. It's a win-win, right? I mean, if SF Bloodstock is able to basically participate in the upside of purchasing a Derby winner, they want short-term money. The stallion owner, we're looking for the long-term. We're looking for that increased stud fee. We're looking for the 10 to 15 year appreciation of the asset, right? So the horse wins the Derby. We get our share of $3 million, which is about, what, $1.5 million after the percentages and payouts, right? But we owe the original owner $9 million. So in essence, all the shareholders, they did make $1.5 million. But at the same exact time, they also inherited a $9 million liability, because they basically have a horse now that has had significant appreciation, and that's the quid pro quo for doing that. My Racehorse, Spendthrift, same deal. We got the revenue. We also got the liability. Now, I'm not going to go to 5,300 people and say, hey, guys, you guys just bought Authentic. You just won the Derby. Congratulations. We actually owe $7.8 million. We got to divide that by the 12,500 owners. So we all need you to send in a check. How would that have done on Twitter? I said, please send me $75 for the kicker, right? So what we decided to do is that we would put the liability into the company, and then we would pay it back once we started getting stallion revenue. So that way you can come in for one fixed fee. You can understand that if you get a Derby winner, you may have a really significant stallion prospect. And the complexity which comes in by actually paying that bonus, we removed by not charging the shareholders for it. Having the liability go on our books, we take care of it. And we won't pay ourselves back until he actually makes the money. So you're almost getting the best of both worlds. Even though the chatter actually became negative, if you break it down, what other situation could you inherit a $7.8 million liability and not actually have to pay out the cash for it?
Yeah. And Michael, thanks for the explanation, because you're right. A lot of people on social media weren't understanding it, and whether they were investors or they were just fans that were kind of coming in to kick tires and to have a better understanding, there certainly was a lot of buzz on social media, which is what you want. I mean, when you have a partnership like this, you want to have buzz, you want to have people following and everything. So we do appreciate the additional, you know, details on the bonus structure. When you get successful in any business, there's always a concern that there's going to be copycats out there. So what uniqueness does MyRacehorse.com offer that, you know, maybe the next ABC, you know, Racehorse.com wouldn't be able to replicate that you guys have in place?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. And that was kind of my last job. We were Casper Mattress in a Box and kind of the innovator. And overnight there was, you know, 30 of them that came onto the market. And I think it just comes down to basically continue to make sure that you have the superior product. You know, if I'm a microshare investor and if I want to get into a racehorse and there are new competitors that wind up emerging, whatever it may be, it's going to come down to who's going to give them the best value for my dollar. And, you know, we built out a very significant tech team to be able to make sure that the digital components of what you're getting are top notch. We have a really strong media relations. I don't know if any of you guys follow the content that the authentic owners got, but even at the Derby in the stakes room, we had people coming up to us saying that my friend bought in, this content is amazing. I feel like I'm the full owner. I own 100% of authentic. And so we basically aggressively invested in building strong tech, strong media. So you're getting content that is almost even superior in many situations to what you would get as the individual owner, because we have scale. We have people on the grounds at every track. We can be, you know, doing interviews back, you know, exercise rider gets off the horse in the morning. All of a sudden we do an interview. It goes to you within 15 seconds. We have scale. And what scale is going to mean to individuals, it's going to be a superior product, right? And, you know, that's a big part of why we partnered with, you know, Mr. Hughes. Is we have good capital behind us. We're going to have a far superior product because we can make sure that we invest in it. I think, you know, but time will tell. That proof is in the pudding for that. So that I can say whatever I want. At the end of the day, we got to put good horses on the platform. We got to be transparent. We got to win a lot of races. We got to give people a great experience. And we're committed to what we call flawless execution and making sure that every owner winds up having, you know, an optimal experience with us. And if that's what happens, we'll win. If it doesn't, and somebody else will take this category, and we're very comfortable with that. The category is going to be massive, right? We believe that we've done everything from the right strategic partnerships to the right type of management team to the right capital allocations to basically own this category. But that will just come down to execution.
Let's go back to the initial $206 investment. Do you get into the business of projecting earnings like any S&P company would? And relate that to your owners.
Yes. Yeah, so as you can imagine, like, you know, forward-looking statements, you ought to be always careful in, like you said, any S&P company, but these are equity investors. And so we need to provide investor relations. And the reason I don't think the 5,314 owners were a part of that chatter that everybody saw the day after was kind of all the kind of dynamic conversations was because they were getting updates in terms of what this would mean. We looked at different horses that won the Derby and how much it improved the stud fee. We looked at projections. We did interviews with Ned Toffee. We went to Spendthrift. We basically created a 6-minute breakdown video of what it's like to stand a stallion and what it means financially if you can accomplish things. Why was the mile and a quarter so important for a horse like Into Mischief, right? And then we looked at the top 10 in terms of what freshman sires were demanding. We looked at the ones who've had basically legacy and how many mares they've covered over time. And so we're giving people all that clarity. So it's like through the lens of, you know, financial assessments, right? You're also learning so much about all the variables that go into, right? The business of horse racing, the business of staying a stallion. And I genuinely believe that's why, you know, our owners weren't participatory in that. Like they were given those disclosures. Now, do we put calculators? I'm participatory in markets and secondary markets and secondary asset classes and that kind of fun stuff on my personal side, right? The volatility in racing is incredible. I mean, you can be worth $5 million pre-post time and you probably couldn't give the horse away post-post time in some situations. So this high beta, high volatility equity that's associated with, you know, the sport that we all love, it's challenging. So we provide lots of education on the variables, but we also are very, very careful to all of a sudden come up and say, we think we're now going to stand for $100,000 because this one horse did. And if we went for 15 years, that means we're going to make $147 million on a $15 million investment. It just doesn't feel efficacious, right? So you provide as much transparency, a much scenario analysis, and then let people kind of digest it from where they kind of think it kind of sits, what's moderate. But we want to educate, we want to provide clarity, but we don't want to overly project. And that's kind of our focus on it.
So far as, you know, you're trying to build a brand, which you've done a very good job of, and what could be better than, Joe mentioned, the horse carrying your silks in the Kentucky Derby, which I thought was a little bit unusual. If you own 12.5% of him, you would think that the majority owner would have the right to have the horse campaign in his silk. So I guess well done, but how were you able to pull that off?
Well, that really just came in the generosity of B. Wayne Hughes. I mean, at the end of the day, he is so passionate about this product and what it means for racing. He loves racing. It's the energy is infectious in terms of how much he genuinely just loves the sport and wants it to thrive. And we both have the same hypothesis that if anyone gets a taste of ownership, they're going to be hooked to the sport. They may get in it professionally. They may become paramutual players. They may stay as owners. They just may become fans that watch it on NBC or read it on TDN, right? But at the end of the day, if you get a taste of ownership, you're going to get hooked. And so he wanted to use the stage, this platform, to be able to move the brand forward and kind of bring the mission to fruition, which was scale. And that's what he did.
All right, Michael, thank you so much for joining us, for coming on and explaining everything about My Racehorse. Huge congratulations, huge success for you guys, and best of luck going forward.
All right, much appreciated. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, man. Thank you. Well. The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. As this week's Green Group Guest of the Week, Michael Behrens will receive a free one-hour tax consultation. Learn more about how they can help you at www.greenco.com. We'll be right back after this message from The Green Group.
The Green Group is widely recognized as the top-rated tax and accounting firm specializing in the horse business. Why do the top owners, breeders, pinhookers, and trainers trust The Green Group as their tax advisors? The difference is experience. Firm founder Len Green has over four decades of experience owning, breeding, and racing horses. First-hand knowledge gives Green Group clients proven tax and money-saving strategies. Visit The Green Group at www.greenco.com. The Green Group, proven strategies to save you taxes.
So that's going to do it for this episode of the TDN Writers Room presented by Keeneland. Remember, Keeneland September starts this Sunday, September 13th. You can stream all the action on september.keeneland.com or the TDN website. I want to thank Bill Finley, John Green, Alan Carrasso, our Green Group Guest of the Week, Michael Behrens, our producer, Patty Wolf, our editors, Danny Siper and Nathan Wilkinson, and production coordinator, Michelle Sabrino. Thank you so much for watching. Wear a mask. See you next week.